Accession number 28625, reel 17.
And I'm still with Mr. Strachan, and we're still speaking about Zanzibar. And you've mentioned the type of accommodation you were in. And could you describe to us Zanzibar itself? Is it, you know, you said it was a tourist area.
Mm.
Was it a pretty area? Was it hilly? You know, what type of...
Mainly flat, actually. We had one of the areas in which I stole was an old herring, which was on the coast, and that was interesting. I mean, it hadn't been used for many, many years, but we certainly used it. That's a story.
Sorry, was that near the bungalow, or was that a distance?
About half an hour's drive away. And an area which you could have put extra troops in if the need be. But we were at the main town, the edge of the main town of Zanzibar.
And was it a big town, you know? Was it like... I know you know Bangui and that, so was it as big as that, do you think? Or was it a small place?
A bit smaller than Bangui. More spread out and difficult to assess, I mean, with shacks and huts and some proper building. The Sultan lived, for example, down in the seafront, and he naturally had a palace-type building. It had an airport, which would have taken medium-sized planes and passengers.
And would you have said the Sultan's place was quite grand?
It looked colourful from the outside. I've never privileged to be in it. I just say it more. But it didn't look... I couldn't compare it with Buckingham Palace, for example, nor Balmoral Castle. It just looked like another gaily painted wooden frontage, as well.
Okay. And do you think most of the buildings were wooden, or do you think they were built...
Predominantly, yeah.
And were the locals quite poor, do you think?
A lot would have been, but conversely, the Goans, the other nation, the other race I mentioned, they were all wealthy and they looked very prosperous, as were the Asians and local Indians, in some cases, were shop owners. It's deceiving, I always find, to go there and make an appreciation and find you're totally wrong.
Okay. And this camp, the stores that you had, you know, which were about half an hour away from Naharim, what kind of building was that? You know, was it...
No, that was stone. Okay. No, the herring was stone. You could see where the concubines had been. I mean, it was just derelict and dank and cold and miserable, but it was a means of storing camp beds and such things as that.
Oh, so you did take... I did wonder, you know... What were the stores you were taking? But I just thought it was food, so you were taking...
No, just hard stores, as it were, tents and beds and things. You'd need if you were reinforced by more people.
Okay, and this building as well, was it obvious what use had been before, you know?
It was very obvious, I hear you, no doubt about that.
And how did
it
you...
It was empty, I may say.
And how did you realise this? Because I've never seen one, so I wouldn't...
Well, it was explained to us, the sort of circular area where the concubines had been, the area where they would have bathed and slept and whatever.
And was there, like, sleeping accommodation for them round this central area, basically?
Yes, but it was in such a state of disrepair, it was very difficult. I mean, it pointed out to us what it was, and you could see from the descriptions given... the reality of it, but rather like the slave trade in Zanzibar, which was well documented, that no longer took place any more than the herring, the Alikan and Witahewa, so they'd all gone.
Okay, and was this quite a large place as well, this herring?
An average size place.
Okay, now you were... sent there because there was problems there.
Yes.
And who was causing the problems?
Well, the local politicians, all arguing as to which group could do the best for the community, all wanted to be the predominant one. Just what you get still throughout the world. The different races just didn't get on.
So it was problems within the different...
Yes, absolutely. And that is why we patrol 24 hours a day.
Now, was this like a state of emergency or...?
No, nothing. Nothing quite as serious. It was merely an indication to the people, forewarning the people that we were there. And if you misbehaved, then we were there to stop it, prevent it. Indeed, it was our main task.
And so when you did patrol, what type of uniform did you have on? Did you have your rifles and things?
Yes, fully equipped, and ammunition with us, if necessary.
And when you say fully equipped, can you give us a description of that, please?
Well, you'd have on your cotton uniform and your academy boots, and you'd have your equipment on, and you'd be carrying your rifle and your water bottle and things like that.
Okay. And when you say a 24-hour patrol as well, was that like a different shift system that you worked in?
Yes, we did. We had patrol going out and in into different area, and obviously not the same pattern or the same time schedule, but there was activity somewhere throughout the 24-hour.
And in the position that you were in as well, did you go in these patrols?
No, my job was administrative. I looked after the food and accommodation and provision of the sewer, whatever was required.
Okay, so for these men going out in patrol, would you have to ensure that they had food and water with them?
Yes.
And what would be the longest that they would actually go out in patrol for?
Again, that's how long is a piece of string? There's no steady pattern, nor particular area. You obviously had to let them see that you were trying to be one move ahead of them.
Would they maybe go out for a few days at a time, sometimes?
No.
So was it more like day patrols was the longest?
Day and night.
Mm-hmm. And were these foot patrols or were...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, you had occasions to use them. Land Rovers, but predominantly foot. Foot is nearest to them, and you were able to note more and converse with them and maintain contact in general.
Okay. And is Zanzibar a large island?
I don't know the dimension, but yes. It's certainly 20 miles one way, that I recall, by 15. Quite a time.
Okay. And we've mentioned water, and I know you've already mentioned food as well. Was there a supply of drinking water on the island?
Mm-hmm.
So you never had problems with that?
No. The only time with problems was when the island was our particular part, or the main part, was flooded through the monsoon rains, etc. And this is where we were able to help the local people move people and move their chattels because of the depth of the water in the local padang, the local central field that they had.
And were you involved with that?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And how long did it rain for? Because I've never been in that situation.
Monsoons vary, but they can, in some cases, rain for days and nights, and then, which is why they have the deep drains. To supposedly take it away and find difficulty with them. But that is where we discovered that water does run up a hill because it goes higher and higher and higher, finding its own level. And this is where our high vehicles that we had, such as the 4-ton vehicle, were very good for moving people and they were able to negotiate the water areas.
And did you have to move a lot of people?
Not really. not vast amount of people, but just we showed willing and we helped on a nice acquired basis.
And were their houses not built in such a way that maybe they could take a certain amount of flooding? You know how you sometimes see them on stilts?
On stilts, yes, you had that, but you also had an awful lot of wooden squat type thing, as well as you had stone buildings too. But the level was such that the volume of the water soon raised.
Okay. And so what did you do with the people that you maybe helped? Did you
put them into temporary areas? Under the auspices of the local authorities.
Okay. And what about your own men? Because they were in tents.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, we just moved the beds and tents further up the hill.
But they must have been wet, were they?
Yes, but you dried easily. I mean, we were organised. We accepted slight discomfort.
And was this a new challenge for you? I know that you've been involved in this type of work, but you know, here was like a flood like that, and so suddenly you were...
You just accept these challenges, and it's a good test for you, to test your system, and test your men, and test your morale, your sort of physical involvement, mental involvement. And the army is good at that. Well, the services are, particularly the British ones.
And how did you feel that you came out of that? Did you feel that there was any areas you maybe could have improved on, or did you think...
Well, really, that is part of the story it follows, because we ultimately went back when they were killing one another, when they had riots. I can speak about the riots in Zanzibar, but in between that is Swaziland. So we've got to move to Swaziland first, and then I can speak about that aspect.
Okay, so we'll just concentrate on the first time that you were there just now. Were you there for long the first time?
We did 3 months, and then each company did that. We were relieved by another company of ones.
So the first time you were there, was it relatively peaceful?
Yes, acceptable. You were aware, but it was acceptable. We had no real, we had no fighting, we had no firing of any weaponry, etc. It would have been much more diplomatic and preventative.
Okay. And when you were there the first time, was there like, did you know who your enemy was the first time? Or
no.
Okay, so it was just a kind of awareness?
Yes.
Okay. So you were there for 3 months, another company came out, so then...
Yeah. And they were also relieved by a third company. But it was after that riots broke out in Swaziland. So we had to leave Kenya, we had to go down there, flew down there from, like by buses, from Gilgal to Nairobi, and then fly by RAF down to Swaziland.
Okay, and so had you been back in Kenya long when this...
Not very long. All within the first year, I would say. At the end of the first year, we went to Swaziland.
Okay, and so this must have been, I don't mean upsetting, but it must have been quite an upheaval, really, for your wife and family, because you went there, you went away for 3 months, and then you came back. Mm-hmm. Was there any support for the wife and family?
Well, they were great support themselves. They had an association which is known as a wife's club, when they meet for coffees and teas and do different things, and they have a committee, and they make aware that the problems that come from such meetings and awarenesses. And you have always a family's organisation which is led by a military person and his staff who see to the needs of people to investigate potential problems, etc. You had a good medical system covered, that you had the good schools, and you would have the shopping buses to the nappies and things like that. Yeah, there was always something on, and they were pretty self-sufficient, independent, and capable.
I just wondered, you know, being taken from like Scotland or Germany as you were then, and then out to Africa, how they'd coped, you know. Could they, or did they ever do like, maybe some of the wives go on a trip or anything? Could they do anything like that?
You could, yes.
It was relatively safe for them?
Absolutely. Kenya was absolutely safe at that particular time.
Okay.
And in fact, we spent many, many weekends. We had limited radio programs. You'd have 2 hours in the morning and about four at night. You'd no television. You were dependent upon, you know, the good old-fashioned psychological system. You know, make your own fun. And it was very educational and enjoyable to take a family, and most of us had an old banger of sort, and off you'd go to the Menengai crater and an old volcano, or go to the see the thousands of birds and things you'd see at the different lakes. There's always I'd go to the game park and see an abundance of wild game that people pay thousands of pounds to go and see a holiday now. So yes, you could even drive 75 miles in your car to an open air cinema and drive your 75 miles back, but you'd have your children lying in the back with the pillows and the blankets. So that was a novelty. You didn't do it too often, mind you, but it was available and it was up to you. We had people who had their own horses, for instance. We had a stable club, a saddle club. We had a stretch of barn which produced big fish. We had people who golfed on two different courses. People who went on safaris. I mean, we were pretty well organised, and everybody was putting great efforts in. We had people who were learning to fly, to glide and to parachute. Yes. Could be warm.
It sounds quite a nice life.
Absolutely, yeah. But we did work. I mean, that was the sort of the sideline, occupying your spare time.
And was this cinema that was 75 miles away, was that the nearest one? And did you get films up in the camp or anything?
On occasions, yes. That mainly from the soldier.
Okay. And was it quite easy to keep in contact with the UK then, because you know a lot of people wouldn't have had phones and things.
No, didn't have phone, but you wrote letters that people don't seem to do now. And we were contented doing that. And the other thing we did was we had tape recorders. They were little fashion box and little things on top. If they had a means of playing it at home, then you would record the whole family sitting around on an evening, and all the children speaking to Granny and Grandpa and so on. But you did that on occasion.
And did you ever do that?
Yes, I did. Mm-hmm. And it was a very effective way of speaking to everybody and everybody here and being aware of, you know, how contented and healthy we were.
Okay. And what about the forces broadcasting as well? Mm-hmm. I think I remember a programme called Family Favourites or something.
Yeah.
Did you get that out there?
I'm sure we did, but we Family Favourites, I remember, from mostly Europe. I'm not sure on that one. As I said, we had limited radio, but that must have been local radio. Then again, it could have been Forces, I'm sorry. No.
And something like Forces Radio, would that have been run from Nairobi or from Gilgil?
If it did exist, I cannot recall, but it would have been from Nairobi, because there were more troops in the Eastern Command, as it was called, and the headquarters were in Nairobi, but you had more troops in there than you had in Gilgil. There was certainly twice as many.
In Gilgil, was that just Gordon Highlanders or...?
Yeah, well, no. In Gilgil, we had the Gordon Highlanders, we had the Royal Artillery, Horse Artillery, we had the Royal Engineers, and we had the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and we had military police.
And so these other regiments or sections of the army, would they have, you know, had like whole regiments out there, or would have just had...
Similar units, effective units, on a par level with the government. We were a complete infantry element. And you had perhaps a battery of gunners which was adequate to support us, but not too many men. And similarly, the engineers were all representative units that would match the military unit that you were representing. And then similarly, in Nairobi, you would have two infantry units and all their facilities too.
Okay. There was one thing just passed my mind there, and it was about accommodation. If there was any maintenance needed on your accommodation, you know, like maybe painting or like even, okay, maybe like say your cooker or something like mm-hmm. that, did you have people of your own or did you get in like locals for that?
The Department of the Environment are always represented wherever you have military establishment, and that invariably is led by a British person, and he may have a few subordinates, but the local maintenance men as such would be local.
It was just when you spoke about engineers, it just crossed my mind.
No, they were military engineers.
Okay. Now, you said that you were moved to Swaziland. What happened there, that you were getting moved to Swaziland?
Well, the natives were restless, and they were going on strike, and they associated problems to that. But the government could well have been brought down. But they were certainly showing the distinct in many, many ways. And we were called to go and be the first troops in as such when we flew in. And very fortunately, being in the first group as I was, we had the monsoon of rains. And very soon and very quickly, having arrived with the boom door of the plane open, ready for us to rush out and go off, and we marched to the area and made it obvious that if they didn't behave, that we would shoot. And they thought that we were serious enough, and they dispersed. So that was a good introduction to the problem.
Okay. And was that still in 1962? Would that have been 1962?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, 62.
And how did you first hear about going to Swaziland? Was that, you know, were you in camp one day or something?
In camp, and obviously through the military system, information was received, what was the problem there, and the fact that we would be sent to look after it.
And did you get much notice that you were going?
Not really. We had to work night and day to collate everything, pack everything, and move off.
And had you to take all these stores with you again?
You would take a certain amount of stores, yes. We didn't take any bedding or such, but we took the sort of the metal side of things that allow us to do our own cooking, and provision of water, and reserve replacements for the equipment they then used.
And was it all the Gordons that were going down there, or was it just maybe part of the regiment or company? Or?
All the Gordons, and we left a small rear party.
So there'd be quite a lot of men going down there?
Yes, indeed, only 500 of them.
Okay, and do you think they needed a few planes to get down there?
Yes, the RAF did this, and they stopped at Salisbury in Rhodesia, as it was called then. And what was perhaps the coldest night that I can recall, spent in a big, big hangar. And the local people came along and wanted to give us beer. And for the first time, Jacques was saying, we don't want beer, we want a blanket. But we stayed there for a couple of days because the maintenance crew of the RAF hadn't arrived. And then when they did do, we flew off and landed at the airport, which is at Manzini, I think I recall, which is where we were going to. And we took over a school for accommodation.
Okay. And would you have just been in like your tropical uniforms?
Yes, absolutely.
That's
the proper name, the proper term. And you have your large pack with all your goodies in it, and your small pack and all your equipment, so that you could move off and be independent if the need arose.
And would the men have had a blanket in one of their packs?
Not that one, no. I don't think we had blankets that time. They could have been issued if we felt the need arose.
And so how did they sleep that night in the hangar?
Virtually without anything. I remember lying in a camp bed in the bitterly cold.
So you did have camp beds?
Oh, aye. Not ours. They produced, the Air Force provided them.
And I know you were only in Rhodesia for a short time, but it was part of the Commonwealth, I believe, at that time, was it?
Yes, I think it had been. Uh-huh. Yes.
Did it seem quite British? Or?
Yes, very much so. I remember meeting and being photographed with the Duke of Montrose and his family, his two boys who were there. It was very much a good country to be in, and successful European connected farmer.
And did you get out with the hammer?
No. Oh. No, we were just hanging on to the plane coming in to get out.
And did you know much about Swaziland at that time as well?
No, precious little.
Okay, and was there any way you could find out more about it?
Well, eventually we got literature and lecture on it. And as and when you were briefed, and you very soon picked up that they were run by a king and his many, many, many wives. And again, you had the usual group of what can be termed political spivs who wanted to organise things differently. And you had lots of workers who would show their dissent and weren't happy with the situation as they were and wanted to improve it. But eventually they realised that we were serious people and we were there to quietly push them in the right direction. So after the initial meeting, you felt it was thereafter a heart and mind situation where on foot patrol you were able to speak to the people, to meet the people, hear their side of the argument, hear yours as well. And it wasn't long before the situation became normal. But we were still there, we were still doing our patrols and very obvious visitations here, there, whatever.
And what was the connection with Britain that you were getting sent down there?
And their affinity to the British government.
Were they part of the Commonwealth?
No, they hadn't been, but I think we have been associated with us for many, many years. And we were just always too pleased to help other people. And it hasn't changed today.
Okay. So you flew in, and what was your first impressions of Swaziland?
Well, it was raining heavily. We were soaked, and we were obviously hungry and apprehensive as to what we would meet, but it was a fairly civilized environment, and we met British people, African people. I remember being befriended by a Dutch Greek person who was very pro the British Army and laid on a truck to get us in, all this sort of thing. People wanting to help, and as and when things began to settle down, it was quite remarkable. The farmers who would lay on a big barbecue and say that he wanted 20 soldiers to come out and be fed, and they were very, very hospitable. And every weekend or something of that sort, they wanted to befriend you, they wanted to entertain you, and they did. I mean, they were tremendous eaters. They used to think that we had so small appetites. Yes, some very, very nice people.